thank you all for coming. This is part one of the week where we have remembrances of Srila Prabhupada by his disciples. I think none of them are coming this afternoon. So we're doing this afternoon session. So he was supposed to come this morning, filling in for him. And I think perhaps last year you had Shruta Kirti, is that right? Anyone here is at Shruta Kirti's remembrance? Two. So my remembrances are a little different in that Shruta Kirti spent his time with Prabhupada as Prabhupada's secretary and traveled with Prabhupada and served him, not secretary, but servant, served him as his servant, giving massages and cooking. But I wrote my memories down, my memoir, and I wrote it from the point of view of a young person converting. I thought conversion is a fascinating topic. Why one person converts, another person doesn't. So the biggest theme, at least at the beginning, is this idea of conversion. And then the next theme after that is why one person remains converted and maybe so many others go back to whatever that was they were doing before. So with that in mind, actually I wrote it for a non-devotee audience. So it's rather different than, say, Shruta Kirti's book, What is the Difficulty, or Harisari's Diary, a series of diaries like that. So keep that in mind as we go through it. And it's a journey, it's my personal journey. And as it happened, Srila Prabhupada was the pivotal personality in that journey. So to get to that pivotal point, we have to, unfortunately, go through my background to understand what happened at the pivotal time. So, from a very young age, I was interested in photography. From like 9 years old, I got a small camera. It was a cube, 3-inch cube from Kodak. And, you know, you could look straight through a lens at what you were seeing, and then you press the button. There was no flash. This is some years ago. But I was 8 or 9 and I was totally fascinated by it. And eventually I started developing my own black and white film in my room, and then I'd cover the windows on my room, and I got a projector and a printer, and I would print my own pictures in black and white. And this went on for years. Eventually I started taking pictures in the high school yearbook. And I have it here, I just happened to have in my computers two samples of the type of pictures I was taking. It's in a museum, is one, and this is a second one. So this, I grew up in about 20 miles from New York City, Long Island. It's a Long Island, and it's about southeast of New York City, 120 miles long, skinny island. We were on the North Shore. It's a rather posh suburb of New York. And this was one of two hairdressing salons. So I managed to get in and do some many photographs of that. So when it came time to go to college, I kind of didn't want to go in for general studies. I went to Rochester Institute of Technology, which is in upstate New York. I guess you've all heard of Kodak. The international home for Kodak is in Rochester, New York. So there's a very close relationship between this university and Kodak, and that the graduates of the university go to Kodak, and Kodak gives money to the university. So that was what I did. And the first year I lived in the dorm, and it so happened that the first year I did a term paper on close-up photography. Technically it's called macro photography. And when I went home to my parents' house that summer, now we're in the summer of 1969, I took that term paper to a publisher in New York City. And just by some fluke, that publisher wanted a book on that subject. So that summer I was 19 years old and I signed a contract with this publisher to make a book on close-up photography. So I was thrilled by the opportunity, naturally. And when I went back to school for the sophomore year, the second year, I moved out of the dorm into an old colonial house that was divided into subsections for renters because I needed some time and space to do this because I was also doing my second year in college. So I couldn't have distractions, I thought. So I was busy at work. This is now in September of 1969. I'm busy at work in this ground floor apartment of this old colonial house, rewriting this manuscript to go with the photographs for this book, right? And this is before computers, so it means if you made a mistake on a page, you had to rewrite the page to get it a clean copy. It's hard to imagine. But actually, that's what we had to do. We made all the corrections on the page, and then we rewrote it, including all the corrections. And if there are corrections after that, you had to rewrite it again to get a clean copy. It's very primitive by today's standards. So I was there, and I was rewriting this book for about the third time. And I was very bored, but I was very determined that I was going to complete this thing. So there I am, you know, typing away, and there's a knock on the door, right? And it so happens that my professor lives on the third floor of this building, Owen Butler, and it's a Saturday, right? And I had been to school all that week. I just finished the school for the week. But Owen Butler says to me, "We're hanging some pictures in the student union. We're having a exhibit of photographs, and we need some help hanging up these pictures. Can you please come help?" So I was standing there at the door. You know how it is. In a split second, you think, I have something to do. It's cold outside. You know, I've been to school all Monday through Friday. I finished with it. But this is my professor, and I wanted to get his good side. So I said, sure, I'd be happy to. Why not? So we go to this school, and in the student union is a very large room, as big as a gymnasium, but not the same shape, modern architecture. And I go through the revolving doors, and there may be, you know, three or four dozen students milling around. And I zero in on one person who's on the far wall, talking very casually to somebody. He's kind of leaning against the wall with his knee up like this, very relaxed. And something in my brain says, that's him. I never saw him before. I thought he must be a freshman because I hadn't seen him the first year. So we're hanging pictures together, this person and I. And I said to him, that was my first question, are you a freshman? And he said, no. He had already graduated from the University of Berkeley, California. And now he was getting his master's degree in photography at Rochester Institute of Technology. So we became boyfriend and girlfriend. That's what happened. And we spent that year, he was working on his master's, I was working on this book in my second year of college. We spent that year together, and then that summer I took him to my parents' house to introduce him to my parents. His name was John. So when we were at home in my, you know, the suburb of New York City, John went to a photo agent in New York City, and he gave him his resume, photographic resume. So we're together in Great Neck at my home, and a phone call comes. And this very photo agent says, the editor of Azure magazine has come to my office. He's seen your portfolio, and he wants to do a story on the Hare Krishna people. Because he came to New York City, and he saw these devotees chanting, and it was a little bit of Asia that had arrived in New York City, and he thought it'd be a great story for Azure magazine. So John says, sure. So the result of that was that John and I moved into the Brooklyn Temple for a week. And I should say at this point that John's mother was a Christian Scientist. His father was agnostic. But he had some softness in his heart for mysticism and spirituality. Whereas both my parents were atheists, completely. My father was raised very strict Jewish tradition, which means the lights were out on Friday at 5, and they had kosher silverware and non-kosher silverware. It's very strict. But for him, it was all ritual with no philosophy. So when he became of age, he just said it wasn't for him. Meanwhile, my mother had been in the Church of England, and also very strict. If you didn't go to church on Sunday, you were condemned to hell. And she did the same thing. When she became of age, she thought, there's no philosophy here, there's no rhyme or reason, so she gave it up. So when they were together, they were atheists, and they raised my brother and I as atheists. So it means my whole life, I really never, unless there was some nice stained glass, I never went into a church or a mosque or a temple, right? And I also thought the people who are religious were a little bit soft in the head. they just couldn't face the hard facts of life, that there's no real meaning to life, and it's just a combination of chemicals and so on. So we were, John and I were coming to the temple from very different spaces. So he saw the color and the culture and the excitement, and I saw people that were, you know, zombies, really. Zombies. And also it was, at that time, the Brooklyn Temple, as many temples, were very short of funds. So the prasadam was quite austere. Like, for instance, they didn't have plates. Like, we have plates here. Well, they didn't have, not only didn't they have metal plates, but they didn't have paper plates. Which means that when it came time for prasadam, each person got a piece of wax paper about this big, you know, about 12 inches high. And that would be on the floor in front of you. You just sit on the floor, and then they'd serve, say, the oatmeal. And you had to try to eat it before it spread beyond the edges of the wax paper. And that was, you know, similar for wet subjects. It was the same kind of struggle to keep it contained before it went onto the floor. So I was there for a week, and I lost 10 pounds in that week. But meanwhile, also, Bhavananda at that time was the temple president. He had a very strong way of preaching. And I thought, you know, who is he to tell me what I should do with my life? This is just too much. But John, again, John was very receptive. So, what happened was, this is some of the close-up photography that I was working on. Does anyone know what that is?
Couch.
Very good. That was actually the cover of the book. Any guesses what that is? This is an artichoke heart. That's one thing I loved about close-up photography, that when you got very close to something, even something familiar, you lost sight of what it was. You just saw the beauty of that thing. It's hard to see. Can you tell what that is? Grapes. That's a seed button. So these were part of the project that I was doing. And this became John's work on the cover of Asia Magazine. That's December 20th, 1970. He actually took these pictures during the summer, but they were published a little bit later. So I can read to you what the editor of the Asia Magazine wrote for this issue. He says, the Hare Krishna people featured in this issue is the result of a coincidence. A few weeks ago, while coming out of our New York office at 122 East 42nd Street, I was greeted by very familiar sounds, the brassy clang of cymbals, the resonance of Indian drums, and the chant of Hindu hymns. On the pavement, encircled by a curious crowd, was a bizarre group of men and women. The men with heads clean-shaven, the women graceful in saris, all clad in saffron. Within days, we had the American freelancer, John Greiser, on their trail, joining them in their street corner conclaves, visiting their temple in New York and their commune in West Virginia. Days later, I encountered a similar group, the same chant, the same clang, the same saffron robes, opposite the Sony building on the Ginzen in Tokyo. That put our Tokyo-based photographer, Takeshi Takihara, on their Japanese trail. Judging by the progress of these pilgrims, it will not be long before you hear the Hare Krishna sounds and see the sights in your streets. So he got the spirit of in every town and village. So this was the picture. These were the pictures that John took at that time in New York City. And then this, he went to New Vrindavan in West Virginia. And then the last page was the photographer in Japan took those pictures. So that fall, now we're in the fall of 1970, my book of photography was released. And after 2 years in Rochester Institute of Technology, they gave the students an associate in applied science degree. So I had some sort of degree, and I decided just to take that. and try to push the book and do something else for a while. So I didn't go back for the third year. And meanwhile, John had to have his master's thesis, had to pick a subject for his master's thesis. And after studying Zen Buddhism for a while and going to the Zen Buddhist Center, he had originally thought to do that, but the Zen Buddhist practitioners would just ignore him when he came in. They were sitting against the wall, meditating on the sound, one hand clapping. So he decided against that. But meanwhile, the devotees, when he came to the temple, they were very excited about his pictures and, of course, about this article that he had, and all enthusiastic. So he decided to do his master's thesis on the Hare Krishna people. And at that time, it just happened, by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, that the first group of devotees was going with Srila Prabhupada to India. Before Prabhupada had gotten sick, he had a heart attack, and he had gone just with one disciple. He had come back, and the movement was revived, and now he was returning to India with a small group of devotees. So the devotees went separately from Prabhupada. Prabhupada went first to Dainippon in Tokyo, where he negotiated the publication of his literature. Then he went from there to Calcutta. It was the first time he'd been back to Calcutta in 3 years. And from there he went to Bombay. And he met the devotees that had come from the West in Bombay. And John Greiser was there too. That is John Greiser on the right, with his camera. And on the left you have Rishi Kumar, Srila Prabhupada, Giriraj, and Tushta Krishna. And this is, in Bombay, this is called the Gateway of India. How many are familiar with the Gateway of India? Yes, it's this huge monolith, ugly as can be, erected by the British to welcome the king and queen when they came to visit India, around Britain. So, John begins his adventure, and he would regularly write to me. But I can read, first of all, before we get there, I can read how the devotees were received in Mumbai, or in Bombay, as it was called then, by the public, or at least the newspapers. This was an article on October 10th in the Times of India. A group of Americans, including women with babes in arms, belonging to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, ISKCON, has been moving around Bombay during the past few days, chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, to be accompanied of cymbals, castanets, and drums, or dungums. Can the materialistic West, or at any rate, a microscopic part of it, have turned at last to embrace the spiritualism of the East? I met several of the kirtan chanting Americans who have come here to attend the 7th All India Conference at the Bharata Sadhu Samaj, which begins here today, and was at once struck by their sincerity and utter surrender to the cult they have adopted. The Vaishnavas of Mathura could not be so guileless, I thought, as this band of bhakti enthusiasts. So the devotees were very well received by the public and by the press when they came and did kirtan in Mumbai. To their, many times to the devotees' astonishment, they couldn't believe, compared to the treatment they had gotten in the West when they were ridiculed and ignored at best, or sometimes insulted. So when they got to India, it was a completely different mood. And John wrote to me, his first letter to me, he says, I spoke with Prabhupada this morning. He asked me if I was enjoying being with them and what I had learned. He said that some of his devotees who wear the robes and seem like devotees are not actually devotees because they have not given up attachments. I have seen that too much in living with the devotees. They hardly measure up to the way a true devotee should act in some cases. Prabhupada recognizes this. He really is compassionate and understanding. His only idea is that people, no matter how they fumble, should find Krishna. He doesn't let petty things bother him. I went with him on his walk yesterday and had trouble keeping up. He is 75. So it was a whole new experience, not only for the devotees, but also for John, being there at that time. So from Bombay, they had a very successful program, outdoor program. And Prabhupada was very strong in his preaching. And the people were quite taken by the whole new adventure of Westerners taking up their culture. But there was no center at this time. They were simply living in the homes of life members, or actually they weren't even life members, just favorable people. And Prabhupada started traveling throughout India. He then, when John next was with him, he was in Surat, which is a city in Gujarat. Gujarat is known as the most pious of all the provinces in India. Extremely pious people. So this experience was even hard to believe for the devotees. In Surat, the mayor was so favorable that he saw that the people of his city were so favorable that he closed every factory and every business and every school so that everyone in the town could participate in the Harinam with the devotees. Now you can imagine the devotees coming where people have no idea what they're doing, no interest, and even think it's something, like brainwashed. And then they come to this. So John wrote from Surat, "About 20 devotees and Prabhupada and I are staying in the home of a wealthy man. We are given great care. The people show great respect for the devotees and stand a bit in awe of them. Sankirtan is really amazing. The devotees walk up and down the street today, and hundreds of people follow them, chanting, giving them wreaths of flowers, and touching them. The difference between here and America is unbelievable." So these are a few more pictures of the devotees in Surat. This is leading, this is Jamuna. And that's baby Saraswati with her mother Malati and her father Shantanu. More pictures on the streets. You see the devotees are given garlands. Indoor program. So I can read something also from the Vilamita about this time. We can get more perspective on it. These are all the people crowding in to attend. This down here, see with the Sika? This is Banu Swami, or of course that was Brahma. Prabhupada met him, I think, in Tokyo and invited him to come to India. So this is from the Lilamrita, December 17th, 1970. "It was like a dream come true. Thousands lined the streets for many blocks while the devotees playing kartals and mridangas and chanting Hare Krishna made their way along. Spectators stood on rooftops or clustered at windows and doorways while others joined the procession. The police had stopped traffic at the intersections, allowing only kirtan to pass, kirtan procession to pass. The earthen road, freshly swept and sprinkled with water, had been decorated with rice flower designs of auspicious Vedic symbols. Green, freshly cut banana trees adorned either side of the way. Overhead, women's saris strung like bunting across the narrow roadway formed a brightly colored canopy over the kirtan party. Mr. Bhagavai Jariwala, Prabhupada's host in Surat, had advertised the daily parade routes in the local newspapers. And now, day after day, the devotees were holding a kirtan procession through various sections of the city. While more than 20 of Prabhupada's disciples led the daily procession, thousands of Indians chanted, cheered, and clamored to see, and women threw flower petals from the rooftops. Often the procession would have to stop as families came forward to garland the devotees. Sometimes the devotees would receive so many garlands that their blissful faces would scarcely be visible, and they would distribute the garlands to the people in the crowd. Never before had the devotees met with such a reception. It's a city of devotees, Prabhupada said. He compared the people of Surat to dry grass catching fire. By nature, they were Krishna conscious, but on the arrival of Srila Prabhupada and his Sankirtan party, It had been like a torch setting the city spiritually ablaze. The entire population of Surat seemed to turn out every morning as tens of thousands flocked at 7 a.m. to the designated neighborhood. Men, women, laborers, merchants, professionals, the young, the old, and all the children. Everyone seemed to be taking part. Cramming the streets and buildings, they would wait for the kirtan party, and when the devotees arrived, everyone became joyous. So we can look at a couple more pictures here. To be worshipped for chanting Hare Krishna was just the opposite of what the devotees had experienced in the West. In Hamburg, Chicago, New York, London, Los Angeles, the devotees had been insulted, threatened with arrests, assaulted, and ignored. Of course, sometimes they had been tolerated and even appreciated, but never honored. The daily Sankirtan outing was exhausting, since the route was long and the stops frequent. Many of the devotees had sore throats from singing, and the usual digestive upsets persisted. But the devotees took everything as the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, who was allowing them to engage a whole city in his Sankirtan movement. 20 devotees from the West had just arrived in Surat, as had an American photographer, John Greiser. John went out every day to shoot the kirtan processions, and as he did, he felt himself becoming caught up in something much greater than a mere photo assignment. The people of Surat, who considered themselves Krishna Bhaktas at heart, saw Prabhupada as a great saint, and they saw his disciples, in whom they found the true Vaishnava qualities, as saints also. The devotees' dress, behavior, and way of life showed pure bhakti yoga, and their kirtan was genuine worship of the holy name. By honoring the Lord's devotees, the people of Surat knew they were honoring Lord Krishna himself. Devotion to Krishna was the heart of their own culture, yet they had never expressed it to such a degree as now. After several days of kirtan processions, the mayor of Surat, Mr. Vaikunthi Shastri, closed all the schools and proclaimed as a holiday throughout the city. Everyone was now free to celebrate the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and chant Hare Krishna. Signs throughout the city read in Gujarati, "Welcome to the American and European devotees of Krishna, and welcome to the members of the Hare Krishna movement." Is Prabhupada giving an address? So again, we can go back to a letter from John. "I met Prabhupada in the morning after I arrived. He was nice to me and asked me what I was doing and if I studied their philosophy. I showed him a copy of Asia magazine and he liked the pictures. All the Indians in town have seen it by now." And this is another letter a few days later. "I am still in Surat and I'm still rushing around with the devotees to speaking, eating, and chanting engagements. There is no end to it. Today we went to an industrial site, and the people there had a large carpet covered with a soft mat spread out on the grass under the trees. The devotees and Prabhupada sat there and chanted, as did the hundreds of Indian people. I took a few rolls of Prabhupada as he was lecturing to them. He really is an amazing old man. Indians question his ideas, and he beats them every time. His logic and reasoning is unbeatable, it seems. He uses analogies and draws on what people know to explain what they don't know. The devotees are a strange bunch. I have seen that some of them have lost a sense of their selves and have become almost like puppets following Prabhupada around. They are not pleasant to be around. It seems that there must be a self for the teachings to act on. In this way, there is discovery. It is against the philosophy to deny one's individual self, and it seems that this is what some of the devotees are doing. It is sad to see, and Prabhupada recognizes it, that he continues to lecture and tries to explain as fully as he can what he has discovered." So again, a few days later, these letters were coming several times a week. "Traveling with the devotees is like going on a road show. There are big crowds wherever they go, and it has become to be the same thing over and over again. Traveling alone is not for me, and it would be great if you were here. I would like you to come if you want to." So I had an invitation at that time to come to India. And it didn't come right away. It took some months for me to get it together. John went on with the group to the Kumbh Mela. This is Prasad distribution in Surat. That's Jamuna. Distributing Prasad. And this is at a life member's home, or a supporter's home. But relaxing with his hosts, taking Prasad. In India, Prabhupada was very relaxed as compared to the West. There was a noticeable difference. This young boy on the left is very curious. What's going on? So the devotees went on to Surat for the Kumbh Mela, and John went with them. Explain a bit about that. This is, of course, all before I got there, so I have to rely on John's description and from Sanskrit marriage. The Mela committee had given ISKCON a good location near one of the entrance gates, and a few of the experienced devotees engaged workers in setting up the tents. ISKCON's pandal was large and brightly colored, with three smaller tents close by, one for the men, one for the women, and one for Srila Prabhupada. A flimsy shack of corrugated tin served as a kitchen. Prabhupada was to arrive the next day, and the devotees worked quickly, putting down hay and rolling out dharis, large carpets of coarse cotton fabric. The devotees would have to build their own fires, gather their own vegetables, wash their own clothes, and do everything for themselves, all in the middle of a cold, barren, flat, sand home. It was a far cry from being served like princes at a life member's home. They went from Surat, where everything was given to them, to very austere conditions, in the Kumbh Mela. The devotees were in the midst of a great religious festival and human spectacle, and without Prabhupada, most of them were bewildered by the strange sights and sounds. Yogis sat all day in the same posture, while crowds stood watching. Tribemen carrying saibites with simple red cloths, rudraksha beads, and matted hair sat smoking ganja. A procession of elephants followed by two long files of naked sadhus strode by. An ascetic lay on a bed of thorns, and there were still others, extreme renunciates rarely seen by the rest of civilization. And of course, the various Hindu sects abounded, their chants and prayers rising into the air to mingle with the morning mist and the smoke from the tens of thousands of campfires that clouded the sky above the city of tents. So Prabhupada came there, and to the great relief of the devotees. And one of the devotees mentioned that there were these elephant processions going around the Kumbh Mela with different gurus and spiritual leaders. And they said Prabhupada should be riding on this elephant, and Prabhupada replied, "No, I'd rather put Radha and Krishna on the elephant." Prabhupada's presence reassured his disciples, reminding them that spiritual life was neither exotic nor bewildering, but simple and practical. In Prabhupada's presence, the devotees' attractions to mystic yoga, Vedic rituals, and material blessings and benedictions vanished. They accepted that a great spiritual benefit awaited the pilgrims at the Mela, but as Prabhupada had said, to go to a holy place means to find a holy person and hear from him. A place is holy because of the presence of saintly persons. The devotees understood, therefore, that the greatest spiritual benefit lay in hearing from Srila Prabhupada. That's Jamuna with her arms up, doing kirtan around the Kumbh Mela. And this is a letter that John wrote from Kumbh Mela at that time. "There are thousands of people here, and in a few days there will be millions. It was very eerie when I arrived at 2 in the morning and saw thousands of people camped on both sides of the Ganges River. They looked like two opposing armies on either bank and reminded me of something out of Roman times. There are about 30 devotees, myself and Prabhupada here, camped in several large tents." some of the austere conditions. On the right was Himavati, as the wife of Vasuduna. And standing in the back is Malati. And down on the lower left is Manavisa. And Jamuna is serving whatever it is, Khichdi or whatever. This is a letter from John from January 20th, 1971. I've been wondering how much I've changed since I left. Being constantly with the devotees is trying mentally at times, because they are different and very serious and deep thinking, more deep than I feel I want to get. But then again, they have answered questions that most of us have asked at one time but given up on trying to find the answer, because we cannot perceive the answer with our senses, and no one else can give a satisfactory answer. Why are we here? What are we doing? Is there a higher power? So at times I feel like a split person, taking photographs and doing a thesis and trying to understand their philosophy. What a hardship and what drudgery it is to wander around trying to find the truth and die not having found anything. That is the way most people end up. Much better to believe and be free. Do you want to be with me, even if I talk philosophy a lot and tell you the truth every once in a while? Because I do believe that there's an answer for us both. We have to be open enough to let it in and to share it together. So from there, they went on. This is to Benares. John went on to Benares. Is it too much reading? It's all right. I wish I could just speak, but since I wasn't there, I have to rely on these sources. So this is in Benares. On the day Prabhupada was to leave Benares, he met with John Greiser, the American photographer traveling with him in his party in Surat. John, who had shaved his mustache and thought a lot about his future, came to say goodbye until Bombay, where they would meet again in a few weeks. John found Prabhupada in the courtyard enjoying the sunshine and eating gore, date sugar, from a clay pot. Prabhupada asked that the pot be broken and distributed to John and the other devotees present. And while John sat licking gore from a piece of clay pot, Prabhupada talked about his boyhood in Calcutta. This is a quote from John. Prabhupada was talking in his accented rhythmic English about his boyhood days in Calcutta, and he described a gracious city before the crowding and squalor of today. As a schoolboy, he had seen splendid Victorian buildings of white marble surrounded by stately lawns and trees. Suddenly, Prabhupada looked over at me and laughed. "So, John," he said, "I think Krishna has captured you." I agreed. I had known it for quite a while, but now Srila Prabhupada confirmed it. So, after a while, I was still in New York. I was promoting my close-up photography book, and I managed to get an exhibit of the photographs in an out-of-the-way gallery in New York City. And I kind of wound up everything I was doing. And I took out all my savings from the bank, which at that time was $650, which at that time is much more than it is now. Quite a bit, maybe double. And I spent $350 on a one-way ticket that went from New York to London and then from Brussels to Bombay. And I took the other $300 that was left and took it with me as cash for my traveling expenses. And I finally got on this airline. It was called Vasco Airlines, which was a very cheap airline, you could tell right away. And somehow they got us to London, and they transported us the next day. We were supposed to go on to Brussels. So we had one night that we all had to fend for ourselves. All the passengers had to fend for ourselves in London. And on John's suggestion, I went to the very place, London Hare Krishna Temple. And it was, we're in, March, early March. It was quite cold, and the regular women residents of the temple were huddled around the heater in the night, and the newcomers, the guests, were on the outskirts of the year. So I froze. So the next day I had a little time before we were getting this ferry to go across the channel. So I went and I bought a sub-freezing down sleeping bag, which I carried with me, and I still have to this day, which I never had to use again. But anyway, somehow or other, we got across the channel, we came to Brussels, and we got the news from Basco Airlines that the plane that was supposed to take us to Bombay was under repair. So I had to spend 5 days in Brussels. Fortunately, it was paid for by the airline, but the problem was that something happened. I ate something that gave me the worst diarrhea I've ever had in my entire life. So 5 days in Brussels were 5 days in the bathroom. And I look outside the window, and all I see is what I see now is gray. There are gray buildings, a gray sky, the people were dressed in gray, the sidewalk was gray, the bathroom was gray. And I did manage to get out once, somehow or other, and somehow I saw, when I was walking, I saw a little statue of a boy urinating. And I thought it was quite appropriate. So that was my stay in Brussels, and then finally the plane was repaired. Is that statue still there?
It's one of the emblems of that. If you go there now, you have always 100, 200 Japanese people picturing it. One of the most famous things in Brussels.
The statue was also gray, as I remembered it.
It's black, yeah.
Dark gray.
Yeah.
So that's my memory of Brussels, basically, is gray. And being in the bathroom. So we finally, the plane was repaired, and we managed to fly into Bombay. And I remembered, while we're flying over the Sahara Desert, I think, and I was looking down, it was just a desert. And I remembered that I hadn't told John when I was arriving, because we didn't know until the last minute. When, you know, when the plane would be ready. So he, as far as I knew, he didn't know, and I didn't have a contact address for him. So that was a bit unnerving. And then I was sitting next to some people who started explaining to me that this Bhagavad Gita is actually very immoral because it was spoken on a battlefield, and God is encouraging this person to fight and kill people. So that was also a bit unnerving because I didn't know how to respond to that either. It was just a basic text of the Hare Krishna people. It was being severely criticized by the passengers next to me. So I was in quite a state, I suppose, by the time I arrived. And I can perhaps read to you, this is my memory of arriving in Bombay. As I stepped off the airplane at the Bombay airport, I'm enveloped by a burst of humidity and heat that is akin to entering a sauna fully clothed. At the same time, the term third world sheds its mystery. The entire terminal, the tarmac, the personnel, and the buildings begs for a thorough soaping, brushing, and hoser. All the airport vehicles, baggage trucks, passenger buses, maintenance, and catering vans look grimy and battered from decades of neglect. Except for their size, they could be children's toys that had been fought over and abused for generations. The International Airport's construction team is a few men wearing only loincloths who continually shovel earth into straw baskets, hoist the baskets onto the heads of lean, sari-clad women, who then take the earth to a distant area, dump it, and return for another load. So, of course, I wasn't expecting that, and it was quite astonishing to see. So, we have to go and collect our baggage, and it's not like now where you have this very neat conveyor belt coming out, but the bags are all piled in a heap, right? And, you know, passengers are pulling and shoving, so I finally find the backpack. And I go to the immigration officer, and I'm just astonished because his whole collar is dark brown with dirt. So it's a white shirt, and his collar is almost black with dirt. Plus, his teeth are bright red. But I managed to get through that, and then lo and behold, somehow or other, there's John in the airport waiting for me. So we have a reunion. And then we get on this bus, and for the first time since I'm in India, I sit down on this bus, and I have all these dark eyes staring at me. And something I have to get used to in India, because it never seems to stop. But I have this very strange feeling that I've been there before. It's very odd, because I never have deja vu feelings. But I have a distinct feeling that this was something that I was familiar with in one sense. So there's a supporter of the Hare Krishna movement called Mr. Chabria, who owns the Sea Face Hotel right on the ocean in Bombay. And he had given John a small dingy room in the back, free of charge. It had no windows, it was some kind of servant's quarters. But we stayed there, and I was very cautious about eating because I had such an experience in Brussels. So we decided to go and take our meals at the Hare Krishna temple, which by that time the devotees had actually gotten the temple and were preaching from that temple. So this is some of the scenes from India. How many have been to India? Has anyone been to India? No.
Oh, really?
But these, they may look unusual, but these are very usual scenes for India. This next one is a bit unusual. Yeah, that's a real person. That's how he earns his living. People put money into the dollar can there.
Where's his head?
It's in the sand. But you notice how interested everybody around is in what he's doing. So, John and I go to the Akash Ganga building, which is a very nice area of town, right off of Marine Drive, which faces the ocean. Bombay is such a rickety amalgam of disintegration that a simple everyday machine like an elevator makes me dubious. I'm just worried about going up in the elevator. They're on the 7th floor, right? I thought maybe I should walk, because who knows what would happen once you get in the elevator. But the Akash Ganga elevator appears fairly clean and workable. Mahavati greets us at the door of the apartment. A spry woman, a little older than me, with a carefree manner and a quick smile, she makes me think that she knows something that I don't know, but should know. "What brings you here?" she asks me. "I want to photograph the essence of India," I say, immediately wondering at my own grandiosity. "Well, you've come to the right place," she says. John and I leave our shoes inside the door and quietly pass through a small foyer, redolent of two sweet incense, and then enter a spacious, well-windowed living room that serves as the temple. The peace of the place and the kindly devotee stirs a tender current in me. The worn-out, jostling, turbulent clamor of Bombay, smothered in meaninglessness, bureaucracy, and rampant cheating, has sorely taxed my sense of order, logic, and purpose. The ambitions and goals that stirred me in New York seem pointless here. I am confused and feel Shakespeare's poignant lines. How stale, faded, weary, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. So before I had gotten there, John was waiting for me to arrive, and he had taken up helping out in the kitchen. He used to roll puris or chapatis, and then someone else would cook them. So when we come on this day, he goes back into the kitchen to help out. It was getting close to lunchtime. And I tagged along behind them and stood in the kitchen just watching what was going on. And there was an impeccably dressed, saffron-colored devotee there, Indian, who was deep-frying these puris in the wok. And as they cooked, each puri would blow up into a ball perfectly. I'd never seen that before, so it was quite astonishing. And then this cook, the saffron cloth cook, would scoop it out with a slotted spoon and set it aside to cool. After we'd been there a short time, the kitchen door swings open and in strides another Indian gentleman. Also saffron robed, he has an unpretentious dignity and a grave yet curiously sprightly countenance. One has the feeling that his gravity is reposed between multifaceted emotions. Within a moment, he has taken in John, me, and the entire kitchen environment. He walks over to this Indian cook, discusses the afternoon meal for a minute, and then leaves. That, I am told, is Srila Prabhupada, the founder of the Hare Krishna movement. And it was much later that I learned that his standard for the kitchen was that only devotees who are properly attired should be in the kitchen, but he didn't say anything to me or to John. He just overlooked it. So after that, I was going to wash my hands for the meal, and Malati pointed out to me where the woman's ashram is, that I could go in there and wash my hands. So I was wearing Western dress, just casual, ordinary Western dress, and I opened the door that she indicates, and the first thing I hear is this ear-piercing scream, like a primordial scream. And it was Jamuna. She was sitting at a small table putting on tilak she had on her choli and her slip. And she saw me out of her peripheral vision, and since I had pants on, she assumed I was a man. And she and her reaction was, she has a very strong voice, a very loud and strong. And so I was like, wow. And then I, you know, she realized what was going on, that I was just come fresh from the West and so on. So we went on. Unlike New York or London, the temple food in Bombay is filling, with variegated tastes, textures, and colors novel to my tongue, but steeped in the age-old tradition of Lord Krishna's cuisine. John and I readily make the temple meals our regular fare, occasionally supplementing them with kulfi, an Indian-style thick, solid, rectangular block of cold cream offered, and a variety of natural flavors, along with other milk sweet delicacies from selected restaurants. The Western-style cooking served in India is dreadful. Tasteless and unwholesome, as pap-like as Wonder Bread. I'd never been particularly attached to meat-eating. My parents had admired George Bernard Shaw for his vegetarianism. But I had no idea of meatless menus. Bombay food solved that problem for good. Meat dishes there were as attractive as eating leather. Chewy, tasteless, dissatisfying, and inedible. And the life and death of the various edible animals was so public, instead of hidden and cellophaned, that eating meat became grisly. So,
what time is it actually?
Yeah, it's
what time do we take a break? Break is?
We take a break, though.
Yes. We have too much, don't worry, that's too much reading.
Nice.
So, it's juicy.
Yeah.
you get to.
I don't know. Just the Windows default, just wanted to make a picture, but they don't have this. But, yeah, so tomorrow, I'll put it on.
Excuse me?
Tomorrow, I'll put it on the program.
Well, I don't have to until Thursday, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And I'll arrange it.
People, cars, all black ambassadors, bicycle trains and buses, have stormed an otherwise livable place, creating unwieldy traffic and a disconcerted, boisterous jumble of humanity. The continuous cacophony of crowds reveals a raw struggle to eke out a living or to just somehow survive. Staggering numbers of people have nothing but rags to wear and live wretchedly. The scene seems normal for everyone but me. In fact, I am the abnormal one. My Caucasian skin ever announces my alienness, and dark eyes, distracted from their work or idleness, follow my movements down the streets and out of sight. often accompanied by comments in the coarse cadence of Hindi. Once in a while, at the top of some building, huge ads announce Hare Krishna Festival across Maidan, March 25th to April 4th, with His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and His American and European disciples. All are invited. And that very often would be accompanied by a picture of Prabhupada's head, many times larger than life. And I would be looking up at these buildings and see this all over the city. So I can read the background to that from the Amrita. Prabhupada unfolded his plans for the Pandal festival, but the devotees doubted. How would they ever raise the money? How could they erect such a huge tent? Where would they get so much food? And who would cook it? Prabhupada seemed amused at their doubts. You are all Americans, he said, so what is the use of being American unless you can do something wonderful? The Bombay Pandal, Prabhupada said, would be the perfect way to link America's ingenuity with India's spirituality. He gave the example of a blind man and a lame man. Although separately they are helpless, by cooperating, the blind man carrying the lame man on his shoulders and the lame man giving directions, the two can work successfully. America, because of materialism and ignorance of God, was blind. And India, because of foreign invasions, poverty, and misinterpretations of Vedic knowledge, was lame. America had technological advancement and wealth, and India had spiritual knowledge. The job of the Krishna consciousness movement was to combine the two strengths and uplift the world. And one practical application would be the Bombay Pandal Festival. Prabhupada divided the work, assigning Shamsundar to publicity, Tamal Krishna to the Pandal arrangements, Giriraj to fundraising, and Madhavisa to the scheduled program on the stage. Catching Prabhupada's spirit of shooting the rhinoceros, Prabhupada said, if you're going to hunt, then you should hunt for a rhinoceros. And that way, if you don't succeed, everyone will simply say, oh, it couldn't be done anyway. But if you do succeed, then everyone will be surprised. Everyone will be amazed. Shamsundar organized a massive publicity campaign with giant posters and banners strung across the streets announcing, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada will speak in English language about the science of God. Prasadam distribution and bhajan singing will be held by His American and European bhaktas. This is an interview from Giriraj. Srila Prabhupada took Bombay by storm. The whole city was alive with excitement about the Hare Krishna festival. We had banners at all the major intersections at Bombay. We had posters up on all the walls, many posters on every wall, and we had very big advertisements in the newspapers with a beautiful picture of Srila Prabhupada superimposed over a globe and the words, Bhagavad Dharma Discourse is a Hare Krishna festival. Prabhupada's name. So in that way, the whole city was informed of what was going to happen. And the day finally came, first day of the festival, which was March 25th, 1970. This is the same famous festival that Radhanaswami first went to. So he writes about it in his book. So before that, we're still visiting Akash Ganga, and John decides that he wants to introduce me to Srila Prabhupada. So this is what happens. I think there's a picture here. Let's see what we have here. Oh, this is the Bombay Festival. There's a marriage. We'll get to that in just a minute. This is a few days before this program begins, and John takes me to meet Srila Prabhupada. After breakfast, and after permission from Prabhupada's secretary, we knock on Prabhupada's door and hear it come in and enter. This is the master bedroom, its walls, ceiling, and curtains of soft white. Even the floor is white, thin wall-to-wall cushions covered with sheets. Its two large windows, one overlooking the Arabian Sea to the west, the other facing long stretches of beachfront high-rise apartments to the north, are open, and a sea breeze billows their curtains. Outside, the sun blazes on city traffic flying steadily along Marine Drive, while seagulls circle overhead calling. Remember, we're on the seventh floor, so it's really a panoramic view overlooking the city. Inside this room, astir with the airy freshness and exaltation of the ocean, the gentle light contains an expectant quiet. There are no chairs, only a small coffee table, behind which, seated cross-legged, on a mattress covered with a white sheet, sits Srila Prabhupada. Immediately behind him are two large white-covered bolsters stacked on top of each other that Srila Prabhupada relaxes against. On either side of him are similar bolsters, together making a U-shaped seat. Very often where Prabhupada traveled, he would arrange this, that there are bolsters on the left and right of him and behind him that he could lean against. Due to the heat, Prabhupada is not wearing a kurta with his dhoti, but has a saffron cloth tied over his right shoulder and falling under his left arm, the traditional garb of a renounced sadhu, which leaves his left shoulder and part of his chest bare. I am wearing my customary skimpy blouse and thin slacks. Bobbing on waves of suspicion and skepticism, I look at this small, thin-limbed, holy man. He looks at me, and John introduces us. This is Jean. She has just come from America. Yes, welcome. It's nice to meet you. His accent is heavily Bengali British, but I understand him. I attempt to smile while John takes my book from under my arm and presents it to Prabhupada. My book had been published and I was carrying it with me. I didn't actually want to, but John had insisted that I would. This is what she's done. Prabhupada casually takes my book, Photomicography, Art and Techniques, that was the title, from John and unhurriedly turns its pages, handling the book with his fine, long fingers as if it is something to savor. There is a singular grace about his hands. He pauses at the color illustrations, takes in the binding and paper quality, scans the writing style and contents, then closes it and hands it back to John, his thin arm stretching so that John can reach it easily. He says, "We do not know much about these things." Part of me thinks, yes, I was right. Why show him such a book? I'm proud of the book, but I thought it was inappropriate to bring. What interest would a saint have in a photography book? But part of me is glad that he has seen it, glad that I had a chance to watch him touch it and look at it. Prabhupada is gracious yet frank, not pushy, not overly inquisitive, not distant or disinterested either. Our meeting is brief and there has been no holiness in the exchange, only a simple, ordinary interaction. I am relieved he hasn't preached to me, for I would have resisted that heart and soul. Later at the Sea Palace Hotel, John asked me what I think of Prabhupada. I don't know. I lack a context for Prabhupada. I cannot be negative about him, but neither am I positive. I am bewildered from observing Bombay's melange of deities. The elephant god Ganesh with his rat hangs above every entranceway and dangles from the rearview mirrors of taxis and rickshaws. The goddess of fortune Lakshmi with coins flowing from her hand loiters over millions of cash registers. Bearded Vivekananda and Guru Nanak, solemn Swami Narayan, stocky Satya Sai Baba, saintly Jesus Christ, crude orange-colored Hanumans, dancing Shivas, ferocious Durgas, and a host of other unnamed beings all around, sometimes receiving reverence, mostly being ignored. The chaos of it casts me down. I need answers to questions I have not yet conceived. So we attend this pandal program, and it goes for about 10 days, and the devotees have me sit on the stage, because actually in the audience, there's the capacity of the tent that the devotees erected was 30,000 people, but the entire audience is filled with Indians. Padmanaswamy is there, but I have no knowledge of that, and I certainly didn't see him. And actually, in Sharanagati, there's another Caucasian person who was also there, Dadi Harta.
Was there the same pandal?
But as far as I could see, it was entirely Indians. And on the stage was entirely Caucasians except for Srila Prabhupada. So I felt more comfortable being on the stage. So somehow the devotees wrapped me up in the sari. I had no idea where it began or ended. And I was sitting on the stage, and I felt at first very out of place because I wasn't a devotee. I wasn't even very sympathetic to the devotees. And but it was a better angle from the stage, and I was always interested in angles and so on. So I sat there and listened and watched. I was quite amazed by what had happened here. I can go over that a bit. Well, we had, maybe I can backtrack a few days, we had a little adventure, John and I, that I had mentioned that I took all my savings and spent most of it, or more, a little more than half of it, on the plane ticket, and I had $300 that I gave to John, which he put in his wallet, and he put it in his jean pocket in the front. And we decided to take a little break, and we went to a racetrack, horse racetrack, outside of Bombay by train. And we were watching this. It was kind of a, just a diversion course, innocent diversion, more or less. And it so happened that John picked, out of three races, he picked three horses that would win, and each horse that he picked won, but he didn't bet because Prabhupada said the gambling wasn't right. So that was an interesting phenomenon. Then we were going back, and we decided to save money. We went on a third-class train instead of first class. And it turns out that when we arrived back in Bombay, someone had pickpocketed John's wallet, which was all the money that I had given to him and put in that wallet. When we paid for the ticket, someone saw the flash of dollars. And it was just a matter of time before we were relieved of those dollars. So we were penniless. Turned out we were in India and didn't have anything, but everything we owned was in John's wallet. So I had a few doubts about John's prudence at that point in time. And it turns out that John had a very generous and supportive father. He grew up in Orange County, California. And he sent a wire to his dad. And his dad responded by sending us not only all the money that we lost, but some money in addition. So I didn't know exactly how to process all that, but that's just something that happened in the course of events. So I start attending this Pandal program. Never before have Indians seen Westerners do these things that are traditional to their own culture. Since India's independence in 1947, Nehru and other leaders have been urging Indians to become industrialized, modernized, westernized. And now the Westerners are becoming Indianized. What is the logic? What is going on? So I was really overwhelmed by this scenario that I was in the middle of. Because you have to figure that first I was in the Brooklyn Temple, which was very eccentric and austere and really, in some ways, unhealthy, I think, even objectively speaking. And then I went to London, where I practically froze to death. And then here, the Akash Ganga building, which was very beautiful, but nothing at all to prepare me for this Pandal, which was in the center of Bombay. And the major program was in the evening. And every evening, 10,000, 15,000 people would stream into this Pandal. Some would just come to see the deities. There are beautiful deities there. And some would come and see the deities and take a prasadam, and some would also enjoy the kirtan. And many would stay for Prabhupada's lecture. Here I wrote, "The Western Hare Krishna devotees in India are an odd, ill-fitted group as far as their personalities and backgrounds. But they have been recruited by Srila Prabhupada, and whatever they don't have in common with each other, and there is a lot, they make up for in their bold 100% endorsement of Srila Prabhupada and his mission. Their enthusiasm exudes on that Pandal stage, springing forth in song and romping vivaciousness to make an indelible impression on the droves that see it. And the infatuation of all those people astonishes me." So I'm more or less observing this and astounded, I guess, to put it in one word. The Prabhupada comes in the evening, the first evening, and he starts singing Jai Radha Madhava. And I'm very much overwhelmed by his singing. I cannot place his voice. It is neither Western nor Eastern nor anything in between. Its refined baritone strains are full of confidence and resonant emotions. The devotees around me, two of them playing drums in time and several more playing small hand cymbals like Srila Prabhupada's, respond by singing the same words. The Prabhupada continues singing in deep concentration. Finally, he stops and he addresses these probably 15,000 people that have assembled. The first night of the pandam. So, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you very much for your taking so much trouble in participating with us in this great movement of Krishna consciousness. People are putting different theories, philosophical speculations, but those will not solve the problems of the world, because not only during this age, but in all other ages also, there are different philosophers, different scriptures. That is the law of this material universe. Here there is no oneness, duality. This world is meant for duality. It doesn't matter in what condition of life you are now. You may be an Indian, you may be a European, you may be American, you may be Hindu, you may be Christian, you may be Muhammad. But you should think that you are an eternal servant of God or Krishna. Krishna is the right terminology, what we mean by God. So that consciousness will save you. And that consciousness will make my life, this human form of life, perfect. You'll be surprised. You have seen the sample of one Krishna-conscious child. She's always dancing and she's always jolly, chanting Hare Krishna. Prabhupada here was referring to Saraswati, Shamsundar Malati's daughter. She was about 3 or 4. And every evening when Prabhupada sat on the Vyasa sign, they would give Saraswati the garland, and she would go up to Prabhupada and garland in front of the entire crowd of attendees at this pandal. So here he's saying, this little girl the other day, we were walking in the hanging gardens, and as soon as she saw some flower, immediately she expressed her opinion that these flowers should be taken and made into a garland for Krishna. This is Krishna consciousness. She is being taught from the very beginning of her life how to become Krishna conscious. So it is not difficult. It depends only on training. Even in this old age, and especially in this age, this method is very simple. Simply we have to agree to accept it, that's all. Otherwise, Krishna consciousness is the simplest form of self-realization and advancement in spiritual life. So, in the Lilamrita, Giriraj comments on also the same series of lectures, and he was already an initiated devotee, so he has a very different kind of take than I did, being a complete newcomer. So I can just read his, so you get a different perspective on Prabhupada's lectures of the Krasmadana this time. Prabhupada was preaching forcefully to the people of Bombay, and every evening the pandal was packed with at least 20,000 people. Srila Prabhupada would preach so strongly, emphasizing following religious principles. He knew that these people are Hindus, but they are not following these principles. Prabhupada was speaking so powerfully that I knew that what he was saying would be hard for many of the audience to accept. At that time, I was thinking that if Prabhupada had wanted to flatter the audience or compromise his philosophy, he could have attracted millions of followers. But because he was preaching so boldly and forcefully without compromise, many of the audience did not like it because it was a challenge to their sense gratification and to their sentiment. But in fact, the audience was completely wild about Prabhupada and about ISKCON. And last day of the pandal, we had this wedding that you see here. There's two pictures of it. It's the bride and groom at the bottom. That's Saraswati. Jamuna is just above her, Shamsundar, and Kshiradakshai Vishnu is on the right. So Prabhupada announced that there'd be this wedding. An Australian was wedding a Swede, Vegavan and Padmavati. Does anybody know her?
Still active in Sweden.
So when he said this is the real United Nation, the whole audience erupted with cheers. They just, of course, the Indian people have some very special attraction to weddings anyway. And to have a wedding on the stage, under these circumstances, even though the Pandal accommodated 30,000, it was packed and people were still pushing on the edges of the Pandal to have an opportunity to see this marriage of these two devotees. So there's a little bit here about that here. I was saying, when Prabhupada left the stage in the evening after the program, people would throng around him, trying to touch his feet. And the devotees would form a circle around Prabhupada and try to fend off all these people that were diving for his feet. This fervid interaction hardly moves me. So many things are so peculiar in India that I'm becoming numb to at least some of them. Yet at the same time, I feel that there's more than an Indian quality to this swell of admiration for Srila Prabhupada. It was not just the evening, but also in the mornings. The mornings weren't as well attended, of course, because people had to go to work. But the Pandal went on. It was just a tremendous success. Prabhupada took a great risk. It cost over 100,000 rupees. But it was all eventually paid for by supporters and people who came forward very enthusiastic for the Krishna consciousness movement and Prabhupada's mission. So after this, Prabhupada was going to travel. He was on his way to Malaysia and then to Australia. It was at this time is April and it starts to get very uncomfortably hot in India. So we weren't going to travel with Prabhupada, John and I. Rather, we had this concept in our minds that we wanted to do a photographic story for a magazine like National Geographic, that would be our choice, about a quaint Indian village, in a traditional, where they can use fancy machinery, just ox carts and so on, ox power. So, of course, in India, there are tens of thousands of villages, and we were quite new to the country. We had no idea which village would be suitable for our work. So we thought, well, Prabhupada's from India. He lived his whole life in India. We'll ask him where to go to do his photo essay. So we go to Prabhupada in his room. This is Srila Prabhupada in his room in Akash Ganga. Not at that time. It was taken at a different time. This is winter when it was cool. But that's the bolsters I was explaining. So it's like, he looks very like that, except he's, again, dressed only in this top piece of his kurtan. And he was in the room, just with a couple of other devotees, and we walk in, John and I, and we explain to him our concept and our question. We ask him our question, to which village would be good. And he regards us kind of seriously for a moment. He thinks about this for a moment. And then he says, you do not speak the language. Wherever you go, they will simply cheat you and steal your cameras. So we were completely deflated by that. And Prabhupada could see that, you know. So he waits just a moment and he says, best that you go to Vrindavan and you do your story in Vrindavan. So we were very happy to have some lead after that very realistic appraisal of our situation in India. But before we have resolved that we will go to Vrindavan, but beforehand we wanted some adventure. And we also have to renew our visas. So we decided to go to Nepal for both reasons, both purposes. And then we go to a little town in Nepal. First, to get to Nepal was very harrowing. You take a bus on these narrow roads, they're narrower than your roads in here in Belgium. And the buses are large and they kind of swerve on the road for some reason. And when you look down, there's like, you know, hundreds of feet drop straight down mountains as you're going along these buses. And the roads are often wet. So I kind of, you know, you kind of have to stop from looking down just for your own sanity. And the area is actually very beautiful. That Nepalese people, they take these hillsides and they make plateaus, so there's not even a foot wasted. It looks like a contour map, the way they do it. But you can see it here in this picture. this is ordinarily a hill, but they flatten it like this, and every single flat, so they'll plant rice or something like that. Tremendous amount of work and industriousness to eke out vegetables and fruits from the land. Very beautiful. So we go to a town called Pokhara, and from Pokhara we start trekking in the Himalayas, up and up and up. We both have our backpacks, and we fill them up with raisins and cashews, and we have a little cooker. And we walk all day long, and then in the evening we invariably come to a village, and there's no locks on the doors. And the people, although they don't speak, we can't really communicate, but they understand why we're there, and they give us a little place on the floor to sleep, and they feed us, and we give them a little money, and it's a very sweet exchange. And these days you can't do it because there have been so many visitors coming and many taking advantage of the hospitality, but now we're talking almost 40 years ago, and it was quite different. So we go up and up and up, and finally we come to the snow line, which at that time, now we're in June of 1970, the snow line was at about 10,000 feet, and there was an abandoned cow shed there, and we just set up shop there. We had enough that we could cook and maintain ourselves for a few days, and John reaches into the very bottom of his backpack, and he pulls out a little blue book with a picture of Vishnu on the cover. It was Prabhupada's abridged Bhagavad Gita that Macmillan published, and he hands it to me and says, try reading this. So I take this little blue Bhagavad Gita, and I sit on this rock, and I'm surrounded by the highest mountains in the world. We're all by ourselves, and I try to read Bhagavad Gita, right? And I can't really understand it. It doesn't really make sense to me. But I get the idea that there's something extraordinarily precious here, extraordinarily worthwhile. Let's see. I wrote something about it. I can find it. Despite the pristine environs, I understand little. Yet my entrenched cynicism abates slightly. I am intrigued. The idea of tolerating dualities and remaining equipoised in their midst entices me, as does the concept of an eternal presence within all living beings, and the thought of improving my character as well as the quality of my life through knowledge. So then, after about 3 days, we run out of supplies, so we start down the mountain. And in a very short time, about minutes, of our walking, we come across a group of Buddhist monks who are walking to their monastery in rows of twos. We hadn't known about these quiet neighbors. For a moment, I stand and watch them, confounded. They wear simple robes and homemade shoes and are unencumbered by baskets or backpacks, or it seems, from the immense strain of material wants and meaningless suffering. They walk silently and somehow seem unearthly, as if they are removed from duality, past and future, happiness and unhappiness, loss and gain. They simply are. The fullness of their simplicity, the paucity of their needs, the satisfaction of their being impresses me. Freed of the unnecessary, they have a natural and full self sense of the necessary. Looking at them for a few seconds, I suddenly feel I have not yet paused in my life. I've been continuously running, excited and breathless, in the little park across from our suburban home, behind my high school classmates, unable to catch up. Pounded by some ambition that sent me bounding into college and book publication, and now to exotic places. To see these monks on this remote Nepalese mountain, who are so unlike any people I've ever seen, my swirling slows. What did these people live for? What secret dreams and schemes did they harbor that I never considered? And how can they be pleased by their isolated, unnoticed lives? Are they deprived and a little crazy, or have they found something far better than worldly sanity? Before this glimpse, I hadn't thought about people who devote themselves to life's questions, people who harmonize their lives with a higher purpose, people whose choices are not ultimately governed by base delights, whose lives are not lived at the mercy of passions. After this glimpse, the long descent down the mountain becomes an epiphany, a misty epiphany. I admit to feelings that I had only before nibbled at me. And then I reflected that I had worked over the summer in New York City. I had worked for a famous photographer, photojournalist W. Eugene Smith, who was at that time known as one of the best 10 photographers, photojournalists in the world. And it turns out that he himself was very debauched in his own life. He was divorced from his wife and living with a very young Japanese girl who could have been his daughter. And she told me, this Japanese girl told me, that as he grew older, this famous photographer was becoming more embittered and more disappointed. And also, the summer before that, I had worked for a commercial photographer in New York City. It was Peter Oliver. He was British, very respected photographer, but he had divorced his wife. He was paying for a psychiatrist to see his two small children, and he was dating a model, which was very unfortunate because when he did his jobs, he had to hire according to the job. He couldn't necessarily hire his girlfriend, so he would hire another model, and then he'd have to do the shoot in secret because his girlfriend would come to the studio and say, you know, where is Peter, when is Peter, and so Peter's off in the location, because Peter didn't want to know his model girlfriend, and her to know that he had hired another model was, you know, really crazy. And then I got to know these models. These are the people that you see on the cover of Vanity magazine and Cosmopolitan, big magazines. And it's very sad, but they're very neurotic people. They're, like, first of all, they can't eat properly. It's always diet cottage cheese, diet coke, things, because they're always conscious of how many pounds they weigh. And then when they talk to you, it's always about climbing up the ladder, you know, so they can get more work. It was, you know, I realized it was a very sick profession. I was completely turned off to it after that month or two of working in that field, commercial field. So I had all these thoughts as we're going down the mountain here, and really wondering what my position was in life, you know, what my direction was and purpose. Here's another picture from Nepal. In Nepal, an exhilarating realm beyond the little one I know, wafts past me. It is a mysterious and enticing realm, a realm with a radically different way of thinking, of living, of perceiving, and of choosing. A realm with totally different values and attachments. It is like suddenly getting a fisheye lens. Everything looks completely new. I return to civilization, Kathmandu, feeling shiftless. It is a new feeling, too unclear to express, but too strong to ignore. Unexpectedly, my life has been scythed and husked, and is lying before me. Husks are supposed to surround seeds and fruits. What fruits are forming in my life? Are they rotten? What purposes are mine? Are they worthy? So, maybe we should have some discussion. If there's any discussion or comments, or if we should go on at this point. This is like a juncture. We go from here, we follow after this trip to Nepal, we follow Prabhupada's instructions and went to Vrindavan. That was in July, August of 1971. 71. So, maybe there's some discussion or comments?
So just to have a feeling, how much approximately time passed now from the first time you had contact when you started till now?
I think I mixed up the years a bit. I arrived in India in March of 1971. So now we're we went to Nepal in June, same year, 1971.
No, but when did you first had a contact?
Oh, okay, that would be 70.
So,
that's the magazine article? Asia Magazine or...
I just wondered if maybe I missed it at the beginning, but how old were you at that time? Because it seems you had a lot of experiences already in the professional field.
When I went to India, I was 20. But then I became 21 in India. Became 21 in May 1971. So we arrive in Vrindavan. Past midnight, one hot summer July, 1971, after 2 days and two nights on a dirty train, and after a bumpy, cramped, long ride in a tired, antiquated bus, John and I arrive in Vrindavan. Hotels are locked, streets are deserted, and the only noises are occasional soft grunts or shuffles from dozing animals. We sleep on a sandstone ledge outside an ashram and wake up the next morning to a symphony of birds and the common bustle of Indian village life. A woman bends low to sweep the unpaved road with a short, stiff straw broom, raising billows of dust. A man washes cloth by pounding it against a large, flat rock. A girl coaxes flames from a small cow dung fire to cook breakfast for her family. A fruit salesman pushing a cart full of fruits meanders by, shouting about his goods. A 9-year-old heads for the farmer's market riding a clunky, slow-motion bullock cart loaded with fresh vegetables. Yet Vrindavan is different. The moment I step into the street, the words Jai Radhe are directed towards me from a smiling, elderly woman. She walks past in a white sari, her right hand in a small white cotton bag. I don't know what Jai means, nor Radhe, nor how to return this friendly greeting, but I do notice that the man who is pounding cloth is singing in a lilting voice, as is the woman sweeping. So we don't speak any Hindi, and at that time in Vrindavan, we only found two people. In the month that we were there, we found two people who spoke English. One was Prabhupada's godbrother, Dr. Obiel Kapoor. And the other one is a little old man. We never even found out his name, but he was extremely helpful. And through him, we rented a house near the Radhariman temple. It was a 3-story house. And the monthly rent was 50 rupees, which at that time was about $6. It was a great location and a great facility. The only problem with the house was that in the bathroom there were bats. And I had always been under the impression that bats let out this kind of sound that reflects off the walls so they don't go into walls because they can't see properly, or they can't see at all, perhaps. But something happened to these bats' radar, or else Vrindavan bats are different from other bats. I don't know, but these bats would fly into my head when I went to the bathroom. So... it was a problem I took to find that actually go into the bathroom on my hands and knees because they tend to stay up higher. And then if I forgot and stood up, invariably I get this bat flying into my head. But it's just furry, you know, it's very spooky. Very spooky scene. So that was one problem. The other problem was that, you know, Vrindavan in June, I don't know how many of them. And because we had gone on this train for 2 days and two nights, it was the windows were open and the soot from the air and the cold of the train went into our eyes, so both John and I got glaucoma, which is an infection of the eyes that your eyes tear continually. And then since it was so hot, I was also perspiring continually. And then on top of that, I had trouble with hay fever, so I was also sneezing continually. So I was just miserable, just completely miserable. And the hottest place in the house was on the third floor, but that was the only place where there would be any chance of a breeze. So I would lie down under the mosquito net on the third floor of this Vrindavan house, and just there'd be something coming from every pore. core of my body, the perspiration or mucus or tears or whatever. And John was, he didn't have the hay fever, but he also had glaucoma and of course was perspiring. But he had, as I mentioned, he had some bent for spiritual life, and he had heard that if you bathe in the Jamuna, that would clear up your eye problem. So he did that. And I was very cynical about that. But his eyes cleared up first. I had to get some medicine from my bazaar, and it took quite a bit longer. But eventually, both became healthy again. And then I took to the streets of Vrindavan, camera in hand. So, of course, Vrindavan has all types of people then as now. This person is not following the regulative principles. Although he has teeth on. After I am mobile again, camera in hand, I take avidly to the streets and alleys of Vrindavan. Our elderly Vrindavan friend has explained that I should return the oft-heard jairahe with a jairahe of my own, which I do with caution at first, like someone testing the water in a new swimming hole. One morning I tag behind a few jairahe women into the courtyard of a temple, where 150 women, all in white saris, sit for 3 hours of chanting the Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. They don't chant the way we chant, but half of them, about 75, would chant in unison, and the other half would listen and then they would reverse. Their feeling for their song more than makes up for any lack in its melody and harmony. As I remember, there were no musical instruments. There was only these women, 150 women, singing 75 at a time. They sing in this way, I learned, every morning throughout the year. I wonder at the softness and satisfaction in their faces, at their concentration. So we can look at a few more of these pictures. On my walks in the afternoon, I see these same ladies scattered throughout the town, giving water to pilgrims, cooking rice, begging from shopkeepers, cleaning with those absurdly short brooms, offering prayers in a temple, talking with friends, drying or gathering dried cow dung patties. They have a sense of security that lies not in acquiring more, but in needing less. Many years later, I would read that estranged families sent their widowed, childless women to Vrindavan. Modern families abandon these burdensome women on God's doorstep. But our Vrindavan visit was before such perversities. The widowed ladies I observe are not there due to force, but due to freedom. It seems that each one has declared independence from the rigid caste hierarchy, from petty family squabbles, from ambition and its complexities. Each one has reached the rare point of satiation with material things. Each lady seems to have strong personal goals and a sense of her own mortality. These are scenes of Vrindavan from that time. Like the Buddhist monks in Nepal, the paradigm of these ladies' existence is alien to me. They don't need validation, not through school grades, not due to a prestigious job, not within a family, and they have nothing of any commercial value. Yet they possess the strength and security to be in a place of enough, a place no one in my world even knew existed, let alone is attainable or desirable. In that place of enough, greed and envy have no entrance, and ambition is in individual striving, that is, in doing what one can do, and in doing it in the best way possible. Fame is irrelevant, knowledge is not for show, and power is like a flame, deceptively potent, warm, attractive, and useful. These women are mining a rich tradition. Theirs is a celebration of transcendence as a daily endeavor, intrinsic to their being and as attainable a goal as any set by humankind. The widows wordlessly challenge my disbelief. Something lies beyond my pragmatic gaze. The open gentility of the Vrindavan residents and the atmosphere of service and worship that permeates Vrindavan will not let me ignore this new paradigm. Living there becomes a non-stop novelty where faith is nearly tangible. It is present in the worship of the deities in every temple. And I've heard that there were 5,000 of them, large and small, in Vrindavan. It is in the evening worship on the steps of the sacred Yamuna River. It is in the shops selling all varieties of devotional paraphernalia. And it is especially there in the service mood that lies in the hearts of its people. One night after an argument with John, I leave our house, walk to the short distance to the Yamuna River bank, and sit alone. It is then that I feel how much affection I have for Vrindavan and her residents. The ether itself is soothing. The soft night breeze, the silky river, the gentle sounds and exotic smells, the devoted people, are all rarefied and hold me in tender embrace. The first instruction I have received from Srila Prabhupada was, go to Vrindavan and do your photo story there. And with John as my guide, I have somehow followed that. I'm still hiding behind my camera, but Vrindavan's magic is marinating a cynical heart. So at this time there was no center, ISKCON center in Vrindavan, but there were centers, rented places in Calcutta and Delhi and Bombay. So Vrindavan, as 90 miles south of Delhi, was a natural stopping point for devotees that were traveling between these centers. And when they came, we would invariably meet them. They would be going on pilgrimage, you know, on their way either to Delhi or else to Vrindavan. One of the first ones was Brahmananda Swami. And he and I made a parikrama around Vrindavan. And we had a conversation, I don't know why I remembered it, but I had read this verse in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says to Arjuna, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these things. And Brahmananda said, no, that's not the way the verse goes. Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, not things. So I said, you know, what is that supposed to mean? And he explained, Bhagavad Gita was spoken on this battlefield, and Krishna is telling Arjuna that Krishna is eternal. Arjuna is also eternal, and that all the warriors, and of course all living entities, are eternal. So, another disciple came, Giriraj, and he was a very attractive, childlike, he had a childlike simplicity, but also very intelligent. And he had graduated cum laude from his university, Brandeis University. His parents, his father was a lawyer, offered him $1 million if he would not follow Srila Prabhupada and become a devotee. And he turned that down. Nothing could dissuade him. And Prabhupada was proud of that. And actually, at one point, the newspapers in India picked up on that and made it a headline that even $1 million couldn't dissuade this person. And there was another devotee, Subal Swami, who was quite of a different nature. He was very distant and untalkative and rather sour and didn't associate much with anyone. And also Jamuna and Gurdas came. And that was Jamuna, if you remember, she had screamed when I walked into the So she came with Gurdas, and she's a very friendly, outgoing, Krishna-conscious individual. And she and I sat in the Yamuna River up to our necks, pretty much like the buffaloes do. And she was telling me, you know, with great love and enthusiasm about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan and her devotion to Srila Prabhupada. And I was just listening. I don't think I can comment. But that also, of course, had a great effect on me. And then we were in Loy Bazaar. It was Jamuna and Gurdas and John and I. We were in Loy Bazaar together. And Jamuna somehow knew about John's father sending him this money to replace the money that had been pickpocketed. And she asked John if he would please buy some Radhakrishna deities for her. And he said, sure. He's a very generous person. And she had them all picked out already, and all the outfits picked out, and cooked, you know, it was all ready to go. So she took them immediately to the store, and then she went out because she had things of her own, paid for by John. And then Gurdas, he is actually based in Calcutta, and he has this idea that he wants to do an all-India Vyasa Puja book to glorify Srila Prabhupada. It's Vyasa Puja, which is coming up in September. Right now we're in sometime in August, or early August. And he heard that John and I were interested in and had some experience in publishing, so he invites us to go to Calcutta to put together this Vyasa Puja book for Prabhupada's pleasure. So John agrees, because you know, we've been in Vrindavan now 3 or 4 weeks, and he feels that we've done what we could in Vrindavan. And I was very disappointed because Janmashtami was coming, and already Vrindavan was starting to bustle, getting ready for Janmashtami, and all these very exotic, photogenic pilgrims were starting to come. Janmashtami, you know, was a great opportunity for photography. But anyway, sort of the decision had been made. So we decided to shift over now to Calcutta. Let's see. Without my noticing, I feel at home in Vrindavan and excited by the spirituality of it. In John's view, whatever we could do there photographically, we had done, and it is now time to move on. We can return another time. I tacitly agree with that, although I regret my decision when we take a cramped, warm tonga drawn by an emaciated, bullied horse to Mathura to catch a Calcutta-bound train. On the way, we pass dozens of pilgrims who are flocking to Vrindavan for the upcoming festivities. Some of them are ancient-looking. Some have stiff, matted hair that hangs from their heads like long, thick ropes. Some carry bizarre walking sticks, many hold odd bundles of their meager possessions, and all are startlingly serious. What a terrible time to leave the Holy Land. These are some of the widows that I mentioned would sing every morning. It was too dark to photograph inside, but this is when, after their 3 hours has ended, they're just leaving to do their other duties during the day. Some scenes from Vrindavan. Can anyone read what's written on the wall there? That's it. Okay. It was actually in, we visited Radhakund, the Bhagavatam class in Radhakund, Sadhus. This is the Krishna Balaram tree, just behind Krishna Balaram temple. Of course, at this time there was no temple there. They call it Krishna Balaram. This is a white tree that grows out of the dark tree on the top. And the locals consider it a sacred tree. So, motif, Krishna's lifting Govardhan Hill. The cows and the cowherd boys around, the peacocks. No, it's on the Parikrama path. Worshipping the Jamuna in the evenings. Radharaman temple. Is it Govardhan? Forgotten which temple this is. Does anyone know? Gopinath? That's the Parikrama path at that time. So this is, now we're in August 1971, and about 4 months prior to this time, East Pakistan had declared war on West Pakistan. And by August, which is the time that we're getting to Calcutta, an uncounted number of East Pakistanis have made Calcutta their place of refuge. And by comparison to Bombay, Bombay seems underpopulated now compared to Calcutta. We get out of the train station in Calcutta and there's a path about that wide where you walk between families who have their blankets down, which means that's their home. So they have children, a mother and father, all over the train station, everywhere. They just walk between these families, all refugees from Pakistan. Now when you go outside, it's a similar thing. People have taken these canvas bags that they use for containers, and they open them up and stitch them together and make a tent. They have families living in the tent. And then they have these huge concrete drain pipes, you know, they're like this big, and their families living inside, just everywhere. It's just, I've never seen anything like that. Not a square foot is without somebody, you know, someone's possession, and they're somehow making their lives there. The whole city is an enormous home for an enormous extended family, and what normally goes on behind closed doors is out in the open in Calcutta. Riding from the train station to the temple, we see people bathing with water from street hydrants, cooking over small cow dung stoves, and eating meals together on battered aluminum plates. We see men shaving, women braiding their yard-long hair, barbers cutting hair, people cleaning their ears and brushing their teeth. We see parents disciplining their children, girls sitting together picking lice out of each other's hair, boys playing with marbles and running with hoops and sticks, the elderly relaxing on wooden beds with woven coarse ropes for mattresses. We hear laughter and fighting. We witness idleness and mischievousness and industriousness. It's all out. I just never see anything like that in the West. It's all behind the doors and walls. But here, it's all one home with just uncounted families living there. So we go to the temple. It's on Albert Road. This is the Calcutta temple at that time. It's a Chudananda Swami on the right, Tamal Krishna. At that time, Grihastha. Kaushalya is next to him. It's Chitralekha. And Nenana. This is Jona. So we finally arrive at the Calcutta temple. It's a good location. Albert Road. I can describe it as described here. The building has remnants of classic British elegance, a broad sweeping wooden staircase, spacious double doors, high ceilings, large rooms, and a wide, long marble veranda that overlooks the street. ISKCON uses half of the second floor. The temple room is large, larger than the one in Akashganga, but has no windows, it's an interior room. You see it there. And if you, from this point of view, if you go to the left, you go out on this veranda that overlooks the road. If you go to the right, there's the deities, and then there's a kitchen behind the deities, a very cramped kitchen. Then if you go from that kitchen, if you go to your left, there's an office. So I'm directed to the women's quarters. So I go in here, I go to the right, and I go to the left through this office. From that point, you go through a bathroom. From that point, you come out into a little hallway, which is the servants' quarters, and you go up a winding staircase, very much like the staircase of the palace. And then there is the women's quarters, and I'm sharing them with Chitraleka, Kaushalya, Jamuna. And I feel very out of place. I put my backpack down. And although there's enough space in this ashram, it's somehow it's always dark. There's no light. The next morning, Kaushalya wakes me up at 2 o'clock so I can bathe and join her and the other women in the temple room for japa, the soft chanting of the Maha Mantra. I've never gotten up at 2 o'clock before. It never occurred to me that a person would want to get up at that hour or could physically get up at that hour. I certainly don't feel able to. I feel as if I haven't yet slept. Somehow I go downstairs and bathe, go upstairs and dress, struggling with a sari that has innumerable wrinkles from having dried in a clump because someone, me, had forgotten to hang it up the day before. In Calcutta, it was so hot that you didn't have to hang up clothes. You could just leave them in kind of a ball and they'd be still dry. But when you opened it up, every square inch was full of wrinkles. It's a disadvantage of that system. For a person who is practical to a fault, the sari is not the dress of choice. It reminds me of a verse I'd read in the Universal Form chapter of Bhagavad Gita. There is no beginning. There is no goal. There is no end to all this. But frumpiness aside, I creep downstairs and through the bathroom. It still reminds me of that, really. Some devoted men are asleep in the office. See, the men got up much later. The women were very austere in Calcutta. So they're sleeping on the floor of this office. It's a fairly large room again. This is, remember, from British days. You have spacious rooms. But they're all covered with these bodies of these sleeping men. And there's one candle. So with the light of this one candle, you have to wend through these sleeping men to get to the temple room. So I'm gingerly picking my way past these sleeping bodies, and I remembered that I'd forgotten to brush my hair. Right? Suddenly, I was just about to enter the temple, and Yamuna, who I hadn't noticed, was standing there, and she stops me. And she looks straight into my eyes, my bleary eyes, and she says, with a big Colgate smile, "You look even more beautiful if you put some tilak on." I remember I was in a sari that was covered with wrinkles. I hadn't combed my hair, and I was just exhausted from lack of sleep. And the conclusion was that I'd look more beautiful if I put some tilak on. So my thought was, I'm considered cynical. I thought she was being extremely cynical. But actually, she was sincere. So I took the tilak and a small mirror from her that somehow she had waiting for me there. And I tried to put on tilak, but I failed miserably. The lotus shape, I think it was the first time, the lotus shape was like an apple shape. And the parallel lines weren't very parallel, and they're also very thick and too watery. So it was more or less a dismal failure. And then I went to the temple and immediately tried to chant japa, but was, I found it very tedious. But I was with Kaushalya, who was very impassioned in her japa chant. She sat up upright, cross-legged, and would sway back and forth as she chanted her japa and say each word very clearly. And Chitraleka had a different style. It was sweeter and slower. And Jamuna would almost turn it into a song. So I passed the time somehow or other. But when John finally appeared hours later, and Jamuna told him of my morning activities, she made it sound like I'd been a willing participant, which I really hadn't been. I didn't contradict her. So this is serving prasadam. So it was in Calcutta that I was first exposed to one of ISKCON's perennial problems, which is the woman problem. And it's women should not, and then you can fill in the blank with whatever activity of your choice, because that activity is for men. And, you know, it can be singing, it can be lecturing, it can be managing. And the men who feel that way will support that position with different quotes from the Shastras. And the men who have an opposite idea will, or the men and the women who have an opposite idea, will say that it's simply chauvinism and it has nothing to do with the Shastras. So this problem was prevalent in Calcutta. We had sannyasis there who were young and trying to be staunch and actually were quite hard-hearted. So one day we had a habit that we would sit around reading. We were reading Nectar of Devotion in a circle. And the book went around to all the men, and finally it came to Chitraleka. And one of the sannyasis, his name was Rivadinandan Swami, he said, "I don't want to hear from a woman." He got up and he walked out. So there was confusion because other people thought, you know, she's just going to read Prabhupada's books, what is the problem? And other people thought, well, he's a sannyasi, he must have a good point. You know, the sound of a woman's voice could weaken our souls. So there was a, you know, I was very dismayed by this, and I was looking around after this for Chitraleka. I couldn't find her anywhere. And hours later, I came across her. And I asked her, what happened during that reading session? You know, where did you go and how did you feel? And Chitraleka said to me, Prabhupada encourages all his disciples to be all that they can be for Krishna. His mood is the opposite of the repressive, oppressive, suppressive, compressive mood of some of his disciples. So I said, where'd you go after the class? I couldn't find him anywhere. And she said, I went to pick some flowers to make a garland for Srila Prabhupada. So I was very impressed by her reaction to this needless prejudice. And Rivadinandan Swami was very grave and scholarly and austere and hardworking. But he always had the habit of either instructing others or else making sure that he was a good example for other people to follow. Yet with all of that, women were a threat to him. And actually underneath, you could feel some hostility in his persona. So there was another Swami, Swami in the previous picture, Chudananda. He had come to India before all the devotees had come, before that group of 20. And he had stayed in an ashram with one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, and he had learned to play mridanga expertly, and he learned Bengali, and was quite studied in the Shastras. He was also living in Calcutta. And he was different from Rivadinandan in that he was rude to men and women equally. He was very particular about how we played the musical instruments during kirtan. And if someone was playing them in a way he didn't like, he would walk over to that person and take that instrument out of their hands. He would actually say, give me that thing. Take it away from him. But that only happened when he was leading, because he would never attend a kirtan that he wasn't leading. So there were personality challenges in ISKCON Calcutta at that time. And there were also challenges because we were all, I think every one of us, was Caucasian and unfamiliar with operating successfully in India. So if any Caucasian went shopping, we would get cheated. We'd pay more than the right price for everything, even vegetables. So we had to hire somebody to shop for us. And we had trouble with the Indian stoves and even the Indian utensils in the kitchen for grating coconut. Everything was foreign to us. So we hired a cook, and I'm convinced that Calcutta has probably thousands of good cooks, but the cook that we hired was not one of those good cooks. So prasadam was substandard. Even the ingredients used for prasadam was substandard. And then we, somehow, the devotees couldn't get it together to clean the temple themselves. So we hired someone to clean the temple. And, you know, there must be thousands of people that can clean properly in Calcutta. The person that we hired was not one of them. So the temple was always dirty. So the devotees started getting sick, starting with Giriraj. He got sick, and then gradually we all became weak and enfeebled and discouraged. And at least partly due to that, the devotees started fighting. One of my first memories in Calcutta was the GBC and the temple president walking the entire, in the temple, right, So they come out of the office, which is at one end of the temple, and they're going to the veranda, which is the opposite end. And the entire way, they're arguing with each other, clouding as they walk. And I'm sitting, you know, the new person sitting there, and I'm just wondering what's going on. What is going on here? And they fight about everything. I mean, it's not limited. There are arguments about money and books and life members and position and behavior. Rivadavananda Swami argues with Devananda, who's also a Swami, who's a Acharya. And Rivadavananda claims that a certain group of bananas are boga, and Devananda says, no, they're prashadam. And Rivadavananda says, no, they're boga, and Devananda says, no, you know, like that. It goes on. And then Rivadavananda claims that when the curtains are closed, you should never sit with your back to the deities. Even, we know when the curtains are open, we should never have our backs. But Rivadavananda says, even when the curtains are closed. So there's an argument about that. And then there's arguments about the subtle philosophical points, about Indian politics, about what Prabhupada wants. There's practically no argument. No topic is exempt from an argument by devotees in this Calcutta in that summer. So I'm watching all this, and I wonder what makes these people, especially the women, carry on. And I really don't want any part of it. It doesn't make sense. When I was young in high school, I used to go on these demonstrations to try to get equal rights for black people. So why would I be in a situation where there was unequal rights for women? And I decided, you know, John can stay, that's fine. But better things to do with my life. But before I take that step, I at least want to finish. We have this obligation to finish this Vyasa Puja book for Srila Prabhupada. So every day, John and I go to the printer, which is quite a ways away, and we bring him photographs to put in the book, and we bring him offerings from the devotees, and we do some simple layout there. And I'm quite amazed at the offerings by the devotees for Srila Prabhupada, how sincerely they feel grateful to Srila Prabhupada for what he's given them. But in the meantime, from the bottom of my backpack, I dig out this RIT admissions form, thinking that I'll go back to RIT for two more years of school in a shop. And just flattening the crumpled pages and starting to fill in the little boxes, I feel some relief from being in that situation. But Chitralekha is there, and Chitralekha understands my mentality, and she tells me, you can't leave now because Prabhupada's coming. I did have some attraction to Prabhupada and was curious about him. So pretty much I was hanging on by a very thin thread in Calcutta ISKCON, waiting for Prabhupada's arrival. Seeds. This is in the back is Dinanath. Calcutta Temple. Now this Prabhupada actually arrived on the morning of October 25th, 1971. He gets out of the black ambassador carefully, cane in hand, and glances up at the second floor of temple veranda. His eyes are dark and encompassing, his expression kind, his posture erect, but not rigid. When he sees us standing waiting for him in the street in front of the temple, he smiles, and while still holding his cane, puts the palms of his hands together in a gesture of respectful greeting. We follow behind as he enters the building and walk up the grand 10-foot-wide staircase. In front of the temple room door, he slips off his shoes, enters, walks before the deities, and bows down, lying prostrate before them, just as he has taught his students to do. Then he stands, looks at the deities, walks around the perimeter of the temple room, observing the various paintings on the walls, and finally sits on the Vyasasana. The raised seat on the right side of the temple room is specially reserved for him. From that vantage, he more carefully observes us, his bedraggled Calcutta crew. And this is what he says. I'm very happy to see you again. This movement is not hackneyed. If we chant Hare Krishna mantra, as soon as our heart is cleansed, that is the first benediction of chanting Hare Krishna mantra, that our heart becomes cleansed. If your heart is not cleansed, how we are participating together. Somebody is Indian, somebody is American, somebody is Canadian, somebody is African. Because on the Krishna conscious platform, the heart becomes cleansed. There is no more such consciousness that I am this, I am that. The only consciousness is that I am Krishna's. That is cleanliness of heart. As soon as we come to this platform that I am Krishna's, just like the gopis, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they were thinking, we are all Krishna's. The central point is Krishna. That is the beauty of Vrindavan. All the inhabitants of Vrindavan, the elderly cowherd men, the boys, the girls, the trees, the river, the birds, the beasts, everyone, they are simply thinking, I am Krishna's. This is Krishna consciousness. And as soon as we think otherwise, I'm Indian, I'm American, I'm this, I'm that, that is material consciousness. Try to understand the simple fact that as soon as we identify with our designated body, which I am not this body, so why shall I identify myself with American or Indian? Accidentally, I have got this body in America or India or Africa or in hell or heaven. That is accidental, or by my karma, but actually I am not this body. So he's speaking just the basic philosophy, trying to remind us of what we were doing. And then we offered him this Vyasa Puja book that we had compiled, and Prabhupada was pleased at Abhoya's offerings and affectionate word. And he says, my spiritual master knew that alone I could not do this great work. Therefore, he has very kindly sent you all to help me in this task. I accept you, therefore, as representatives of my Guru Maharaj, playing as my affectionate disciples. It is said that the child is the father of the man. Kindly, therefore, continue your help in this great task and act as my father and my mother in my old age. So, this is one of a series of pictures that I took of Prabhupada in Calcutta this time. It's about 4 or 5. I only had one in my computer. And Prabhupada at this time was listening to Devananda Swami describe the problems in the Calcutta temple. And the whole, for all 4 or 5 pictures, he has slightly different expressions. But his eyes are closed, and he's just absorbed in listening. Perhaps listening. We don't really know what he was hearing. He may have been simply removed from the talk that he was hearing. And later on, we printed these pictures and we showed them to Prabhupada, 4 or 5 of this and 3 or 4 others. And he said that I had captured the mood of the moment. So whatever the mood was, it was there. And the day after that he arrived, he asked for every last devotee in the temple to come to his room. There were about 30 of us. We filed into his room. He was going to have a Vista Gosti to address the problems in the Calcutta temple. And he looked around the room. He was sitting, as he always does, on his mat with the bolsters around him. And he surveyed the room and he said, so, where's Himavati? Nobody wasn't there. So he sent Radhananda Swami to find Himavati. And he just sat and waited. And everyone was finally present. Prabhupada began to speak. And his voice was full of concern for us. And his words were drawn from a deep well of knowledge. He talked not just of the particular difficulties that we're facing at that time and place, but also the attitudes that created those difficulties. And he appealed to our higher nature, a nature that he knew beyond a doubt that we had. His mood permeates the room, and slowly the hard collective knot choking our hearts relaxes. The atmosphere settles. We enter a place beyond calmness. We hear from Srila Prabhupada about camaraderie and cooperation, about tolerance and humility, about steadiness and fortitude while engaging in the sublime service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada says that by evoking spiritual consciousness, by self-realization, godly qualities will manifest in us, and we will transcend the troubles of this world. He speaks about the Vaishnava spiritual legacy, and he tells us of trials from his own life. This was a really amazing moment. Prabhupada said that when he was 70 years old, he had recently arrived in America, and he was living in Lower Manhattan with a mentally unstable hippie who was also a drug addict. And one day this hippie became crazed, and he tried to attack Sri Prabhupada. Prabhupada had to escape from this crazed, drug-addicted hippie and get help. But he kept going. So similarly, he said, we could rise above disturbances. It would require clear thinking, enthusiasm, confidence, and patience. As Srila Prabhupada speaks, our horizons fill with hope. I feel that I only have to stand on my toes and stretch my fingers to touch the firmament. Hearing him is like hiking to a pristine Himalayan plateau, with air so pure that it goes to the head, and one feels like a precious, fortunate, unique being. His words reach past my pettiness, grasp the core of my identity, and firmly tug. Whimpering and bickering and despair do not belong in my life. Srila Prabhupada has aroused some sleeping essence in me, and as much as I have entered his room with a heavy burden, I walk out of it all but floating. My heart dances a little jig, except that I'm not the kind of person whose heart does jig. So, this was really a pivotal point, this to go to. It was very extraordinary. And after this, John decides that he will get initiated. So here he is in the Kalpita temple with Radha Govinda deities in the back on the day of his initiation. This is in October 1971. And he receives the spiritual name Yadubara Das. Das means servant. Bara means the best of the Yadus. So Krishna appeared in the dynasty of the Yadus, and Krishna was the best of a bunch of them. So it's a name for Krishna, the best of the Yadus. I was running around at this point photographing from different angles. There's only one angle here. I'm forgetting its beats. And of course for me this was also now the stakes were higher. You know, I had been thinking about going back to school, but now John, now Yadubara, has made this commitment. So now I really had to search myself to see what I wanted to do. And if I had been wrong about the existence of God. So in the meantime, Prabhupada has this ongoing relationship with Saraswati, Malati and Shamsundar's little daughter. And Saraswati can go into Prabhupada's room at any time, the night or day, in Calcutta, which she does very often. And Malati has given her small Radhakrishna deities to worship on the veranda. So she'll offer the ghee lamp to them and go into Prabhupada's room. Whatever he's doing, he'll stop and touch the lamp to his head. And also, sometimes, I was there once, and Saraswati came in with a handful, a fistful of rose petals. And she threw it with all her might at Srila Prabhupada. Not one rose petal reached him. But his response was not so hard. She has a family of her own. I think she has in the law profession. Malati sees her from time to time. I'm not sure what space I'm on. So, once again, Yadubara and I go into Prabhupada's room to meet with him, as we had done in Bombay 6 months before that. Yadubara asked Prabhupada if he should complete his master's thesis at Rochester Institute of Technology. Because now he's a devotee, and he's wondering if he should, you know, finish what he started, or just give that all up and be available for whatever service Prabhupada had in mind. So Prabhupada asked him how long it would take 3 or 4 months, Prabhupada said. Yes, why not, Prabhupada said. Then Prabhupada turned to me and he asked me about my parents. And I told him they were both atheists. And he said, do you have a brother? And I said, yes, he's an atheist and a communist. And Prabhupada said, how did you come here? And I said, by your mercy, which was actually only partly true. It was also the influence of Vrindavan and, of course, the influence of Yadavara. But I just said, by your mercy. And Prabhupada said, no, it is by Krishna's mercy that you have come. So, that was my experience in Calcutta. Now, just for contrast, I'll read to you what Satsarup Maharaj's take on Calcutta. This is just less than a page, but it's very different from my experience. Not contradictory, just different. Srila Prabhupada had stayed in Calcutta 2.5 weeks, appreciating the location of ISKCON Temple at Albert Road in the heart of what had once been the Sahab European section. Now I'm bringing the Sahabs back to the Sahab quarter, Prabhupada had said. But this time they're all coming as Vaishnavas. You should never give up this place. Some of the Calcutta devotees had complained to Srila Prabhupada that the temple was being mismanaged and that due to insufficient income, their diet was inadequate. When Prabhupada had questioned the temple leaders, one devotee had replied, Srila Prabhupada, I was simply trying to execute your will. Is it my will, Prabhupada had asked, that all the devotees should be disturbed? He had settled the differences, arranged for an improved diet, and had even recommended a democratic election of temple officers. But he had also explained that because Krishna consciousness was such an important mission, the devotees should cooperate, even if there were discrepancies. The material world is like an ocean, he had said, and there would always be waves. During his visit to Calcutta, Prabhupada had also spoken of his plans for Mayapur. Naranarayan had built a scale model of the building ISKCON would construct on the newly acquired property in Mayapur, and Prabhupada had shown it to all his guests and had asked them to help. Seeing Prabhupada's absorption in this project, Giriraj had volunteered to help in any way required. It seems the two things you want most, Giriraj had said, are for the books to be distributed and to build a temple at Mayapur. Yes, Prabhupada had said, smiling. Yes, thank you. So, same place, but very different take on. Perhaps maybe there's some discussion about this.
Because at the beginning you said you wanted to have the beginning of meeting Srila Prabhupada's, you wanted to have an opinion about it. This is your, yes, you have such an extensive time. But now you were with him for 2 weeks. So did this change?
Oh, very much, I think. What really changed it was being in that mystic ghosting that totally altered my. I've had a realization of the potency of Prabhupada's words. It was very profound. As I said, when I came into this ghost, I felt like, you know, Atlas carrying the burden of the world on your shoulders or something. When I went out, I was like, I was floating just from sitting and hearing. And so I became much more receptive and impressed by this message.
When you were speaking to Prabhupada, said, how did you come here? He said, by your mercy. So the whole time you were in Calcutta, you were practicing Krishna consciousness. It seemed like you got the gist of
it. Yeah, took up the chart.
Sure. The whole time you were there, waking up 2 o'clock in the morning.
It wasn't a choice. Thursday or Friday, so that I'll have a little here in the afternoon, and tomorrow the next day. So thank you so much for your attention.
I love you, Shaka.